Hello everyone, and welcome back to the History of Scotland, episode 52, Crusade Home and Abroad. I'm your host Fraser, and today we journey back to a tumultuous period in history, one that saw kings and warriors vie for glory, lands, and spiritual redemption. But before we embark on this historical odyssey, let's take a moment to reflect on our previous gathering. In our last episode, we took a delightful detour from our usual narrative, engaging in a lively Q&A session. I had the pleasure of answering a wide array of questions, from how I ventured into the realm of podcasting to more intricate inquiries about Scottish history. It was a truly enjoyable experience, one that allowed us to connect on a different level. If you're yet to indulge in that conversation, I wholeheartedly recommend giving it a listen. And fret not, for we plan to host another Q&A session around our 100th episode milestone, promising more insights and exchanges, also answering any questions that I missed in the previous Q&A. Thank you also for the recent reviews on Apple Podcasts and Spotify. I've seen them bump up recently and our ratings have gone up. Really appreciate the 5-star reviews, so thank you very much for that. Also, thank you to all the new Facebook members. Now, today, we realign our focus with the political and historical narrative, though with a slight twist. Our spotlight turns to an epoch marked by fervour, faith and ferocity, the Third Crusade. This chapter in history is not just a tale of battles and sieges, it's a saga of leadership, ambition, and the indomitable human spirit. We'll delve into the origins of this crusade, identifying the key figures who played pivotal roles in its unfolding, from Richard the Lionheart's exploits in the Holy Land to the less sung heroes such as Saladin and what he did to bring the Muslim faith together in the Middle East. We aim to bring their stories to light. But what of Scotland? You know, this is the History of Scotland podcast after all. Well, this episode will also explore Scotland's involvement in the Crusade and the significant impact it had on King William I's reign. Obviously, we already know about the Treaty of Arluce and what happened with its dissolvement and King William gaining Scotland's independence due to Richard gaining money for this crusade, but we'll discuss some other fascinating and complex intertwined with the European political landscape, but it's distinct in its own contributions and consequences, that is Scotland's. So, as we set the stage for this historical journey, I invite you to settle in comfortably, perhaps with a hot drink in your hand. Let's turn up the volume one last time on our radios and headphones and transport ourselves to the Holy Land. It's a story of crusaders, caliphs, of sieges and swordsmanship, of diplomacy and determination. This crusade, a pivotal moment in history, was more than a military campaign. It was a crucible that forged legends and reshaped the geopolitical map of the era. So, brace yourselves for we're about to embark on this journey back in time. It's going to be a lengthy and engaging narrative, so make sure you're comfortably seated. Let us journey together into the past to a time when the quest for the Holy Land captivated kings, knights, and commoners alike. Welcome to Crusade Home and Abroad. Since the culmination of the First Crusade in 1099, which we have covered in the past few episodes, just to give you a bit of a recap where we were, it was around episode 28, 29 and 30 where we touched upon the First Crusade. So, since we concluded that episode, there has been a dramatic Christian capture of Jerusalem, as we know. The Holy Land has seen a pendulum of power swing back and forth between Christian and Muslim forces. This period, extending up to the eve of the Third Crusade in 1189 AD, is marked by fluctuating fortunes, strategic marriages, alliances, and a series of conflicts that would set the stage for a monumental confrontation that would unfold during the Third Crusade. Now, the Second Crusade, which was the crusade in between this one and the past episode that we discussed the crusades on, was obviously known as the Second Crusade between 1147 and 1150 AD. It was prompted by the fall of the County of Edessa, the first crusader state established and the first to fall to Muslim forces in December 1144. If you remember in the last crusader episode that we did, we went over the key crusader states, the County of Edessa, the Principality of Antioch, and obviously the Kingdom of Jerusalem itself. This loss spurred calls for a new crusade, led by notable figures such as King Louis of France and Emperor Conrad III of Germany. However, unlike its predecessor, the Second Crusade ended in a failure for the Christian forces, failing to recapture Edessa from the Muslims and culminating in a disastrous siege of Damascus in 1148. This failure not only left the Crusader states vulnerable, but also emboldened the Muslim powers in the region. The internal dynamics of the Crusader states, particularly the Crusader Kingdom of Jerusalem, significantly contributed to their fragility. Successive reigns saw varying degrees of political stability, with internal dissent and succession crises often leaving the kingdom vulnerable to external threats. The lack of a strong centralized authority, coupled with the feudal nature of governance, exacerbated the kingdom's susceptibility to both internal strife and external pressures. In the lead-up to the Third Crusade, truces between the Crusader states and the surrounding Muslim powers were a common but fragile affair. These truces were crucial for maintaining a semblance of peace and stability. However, they were often punctuated by breaches and hostilities, notably by figures such as Reynold of Chatillon. Reynold's provocative raids into the Muslim territories, including a notorious attack on a caravan and a naval expedition targeting the Red Sea ports, played a significant role in escalating tensions. His actions directly challenged the authority and patience of Saladin, the Sultan of Egypt and Syria. Reynold's actions were not merely raids, but challenges that struck at the heart of Muslim-Christian relations in the region. His defiance of truces and targeting the Muslim pilgrims and traders violated not only peace agreements, but also the precarious respect and tolerance that had been laboriously built between the two faiths. These actions served as a casus belli for Saladin, who sought not only to address these challenges, but also to capitalize on the opportunity to unite the Muslim Near East under his leadership and to reclaim Jerusalem for Islam. You've got to remember that these Christians and Islamic Muslims in the Middle East were actually, you know, some were family members, some were friends, you know, they lived side by side with each other. So Reynold's actions and his raids and his targeting of just the Muslim pilgrims, well, it obviously angered Saladin. This period leading up to the Third Crusade was thus characterized by a complex web of political maneuvers, but increasingly by bold actions such as Reynold set the stage for one of the most famous military campaigns of the medieval period. The Third Crusade, which happened between 1189 and 1192, is often remembered for its cast of larger-than-life characters. The Crusade drew together a coalition of Europe's most powerful monarchs pitted against the formidable Muslim leader Saladin. Here we'll delve into the motivations and leadership styles of these primary figures involved and shed light on some of the lesser-known individuals whose actions significantly impacted the course of the Crusade. So, King Richard I of England, we've already touched upon him quite a bit in our tale already with William I and obviously giving us Scotland's independence back. But Richard, he was driven by a deep religious conviction and a desire for military glory. The fall of Jerusalem to Saladin in 1187 horrified the Christendom and provided Richard with a cause to demonstrate his martial prowess and piety. His participation was also motivated by a desire to assert English prestige on the international stage. And obviously we know he got rid of the Treaty of Alluce and sold Scotland back to William I, William the Lion, our William, so that way Scotland could be independent, but also Richard could have a large war chest to call upon. There was also Philip II of France. Philip's motivations was twofold: his religious duty to recover Jerusalem and the rivalry he had with Richard the Lionheart. The Crusade offered an opportunity to enhance French influence in the Levant and to solidify his position within Europe against his Plantagenet rivals. And then there was Frederick Barbarossa. The Holy Roman Emperor was motivated by a sense of imperial Christian duty and the opportunity to restore his reputation against conflicts with the papacy and Italian city-states. His participation underscored the concept of a unified Christendom under the banner of the cross, despite his advanced age, which obviously will come into effect later on. What about Saladin? Well, Saladin's leadership style was characterized by a blend of military acumen, chivalry, and diplomatic skill. He was deeply respected by both his followers and enemies alike for his integrity, generosity, and commitment to Islam. Saladin's ability to unify the Muslim states under a single banner to face a crusader threat was a testament to this exceptional leadership. The Crusader leaders exhibited a more feudal approach to leadership, with personal valour and martial prowess being highly valued, such as Richard the Lionheart's more direct involvement in battle and charismatic leadership. What about some of the lesser known figures? Well, we had Conrad of Montferrat. Though lesser known, Conrad played a crucial role in the defence of Tyre and was a contender for the kingship of Jerusalem. His leadership was a pivotal moment in a crusader foothold in the Holy Land during the critical moments of the campaign. There was Leopold V of Austria. His contributions are often overshadowed by the more prominent leaders, but Leopold's participation brought crucial resources and troops to the crusade. The dispute between Leopold and Richard over the spoils over Arc would later have a significant repercussion for Richard upon his return to Europe, which may involve, you know, a certain, cell. And then having to be ransomed, but obviously we'll probably touch upon that towards the end or in next week's episode about what happened to Richard. Obviously this isn't the history of England, this is the history of Scotland. So in short, when Richard returns, he takes the land through the Holy Roman Empire, tries to go secretly through the Holy Roman Empire's lands, gets captured, gets arrested, and then has to be ransomed back to England for a huge sum of money. And then there was Balin of Ibelin. A key negotiator in the aftermath of the Battle of Hattin and during the Siege of Jerusalem, Balin's diplomatic efforts and leadership were instrumental in survival and defence of the Christian population in the region. And obviously Balin's actions were depicted in Kingdom of Heaven, and he was played by none other than Orlando Bloom. What about Frederick Barbarossa though, the Holy Roman Empire? You know, he embarked on the Third Crusade with one of the largest armies the Crusaders had ever seen. The Holy Roman Empire was a vast land. His journey to the Holy Land, however, was fraught with significant logistical challenges and culminated in his unexpected death, profoundly affecting the course of the Crusade. Frederick's route to the Holy Land involved crossing the treacherous terrain of the Balkans and Anatolia. The army had to navigate through dense forests, cross swollen rivers, and traverse rugged mountains, all while dealing with the scarcity of food and water. The harsh conditions led to significant losses due to these accidents, diseases, and skirmishes with local populations. The sheer size of Frederick's army meant that ensuring a continuous supply of food and resources was a monumental task. The Crusaders often found local supplies inadequate to meet their needs, leading to requisitioning of food and supplies from local populations, sometimes by force, which strained relations with allies in the region. Frederick's passage through the Byzantine Empire presented a complex diplomatic challenge. Although an agreement was reached with Emperor Isaac II, mistrust and tensions persisted, complicating the Crusaders' progress and threatening their supply lines. Frederick drowned in the Salif River, now known as the Kozyak River in modern-day Turkey, on June the 10th, 1190 AD. His death was a devastating blow to the morale of his army. For many, the emperor was not just their leader, but a symbol of the Crusades' divine mission. His loss plunged the army into despair and confusion at a critical moment in their expedition. Following his death, the command of the army passed on to his son, Frederick of Swabia. However, the young Frederick lacked his father's authority and experience, leading to challenges in leadership and discipline. The cohesive structure of the army began to fragment as different contingents pursued their own objectives or returned home. The Crusading army reduced strength and morale forced a reassessment of their strategy in the Holy Land. The focus shifted from offensive operations to reinforcing the existing Crusader states and securing the supply lines. This shift had a long-term implication for the Crusades' goals and outcomes. You know, this massive army had now disappeared, and only a small army would head to the Holy Land. The Emperor's death diminished the Holy Roman Empire's direct involvement in the Crusade and altered the political landscape of the Crusader states. The absence of Frederick's army as a major offensive force meant that the burden of the Crusade fell more heavily on the shoulders of Richard and Philip, altering the dynamics and the strategies of the Crusader forces in the land. Now, the Crusaders, led by Richard, embarked on several initiatives to secure allies in the Near East. He negotiated quite a lot with local Muslim leaders. You know, the Crusaders attempted to isolate Saladin by negotiating with his potential rivals. These efforts, however, were largely unsuccessful due to Saladin's adept unification of Muslim forces under his leadership. The Crusaders sought to renew and strengthen alliances with the Byzantine Empire, aiming to secure logistical support and possibly military assistance. These efforts were hampered by mutual distrust and previous betrayals, limiting the effectiveness of Byzantine support, but they managed to get some Genoese galleons to help them. The Crusaders, particularly Richard, cultivated strong ties with the maritime republics like Genoa and Venice. These alliances were crucial in securing naval support and supply lines essential for the Crusades' sustainability in the region. Saladin, aware of the Crusades' attempts to forge alliances, engaged in his own diplomatic strategies to consolidate Muslim unity and dissuade potential allies from siding with invading forces. Saladin skillfully promoted a sense of Islamic solidarity, making it politically and religiously difficult for Muslim leaders to side with the Crusaders. Even as hostilities persisted, Saladin maintained channels of communications with the Crusader states, employing a mix of diplomacy and military pressure to achieve his objectives without unnecessary bloodshed. Now, the Christian populations within the Crusader states generally supported the arrival of the Crusades, seeing as them as protectors against the Muslim domination. However, the hardships of war, including sieges and economic disruption, strained their enthusiasm over time. Saladin, on the other hand, portrayed the Crusade as an invasion by foreign aggressors, and he found among his Muslim populations a sense of unity. His victories, especially the recapture of Jerusalem, were celebrated as triumphs of Islam and increased local support for his cause. So in short, that was an intricate web of diplomatic efforts, strategic alliances, and varied responses of the local populations that helped underscore the Third Crusade's complexity. Now, the Third Crusade brought together two of medieval Europe's most powerful monarchs, as we said, Richard the Lionheart, Richard I, King of England, Plantagenet Emperor, and also Philip II, King of France, under their shared banner to recapture Jerusalem from Muslim control. However, their alliances was anything but straightforward, marred by strategic disagreements and personal rivalries that significantly impacted the course of the Crusade. A primary source of friction between the two kings was their differing views on siege priorities. Richard, known for his military acumen, believed in securing the coastal city of Arc as a strategic foothold and supply line that would support the long-term objective of retaking Jerusalem. On the other hand, Philip II, driven by a desire for swift action and perhaps a quicker claim to glory, pushed for a more direct approach to Jerusalem. This fundamental disagreement over military strategy not only delayed the Crusaders' progress, but also highlighted the underlying mistrust between the two leaders. Personal ambitions and rivalries further exacerbated these strategic differences. Both kings were accurately aware of political implications of their actions in the Holy Land. One, Richard, would support one ruler of the King of Jerusalem, and Philip supported another. So in short, the two kings supported rival claimants to the throne. This didn't help with Richard I's conquest of Cyprus and the divergent opinions he had of the people around Cyprus as well, and who they supported from a French side. But let's actually move to Arc itself, you know, the Siege of Arc. Well, the Siege of Arc was a pivotal confrontation of the Third Crusade and marked a turning point in the struggle of control over the Holy Land. Arc, a prosperous port city, had fallen under Muslim control in 1187, following Saladin's decisive victory at the Battle of Hattin and his subsequent conquest of Jerusalem. Its strategic location made it a crucial target for crusaders, serving as a gateway for further military ventures into the Holy Land. Recognizing its importance, Guy of Lusignan, the King of Jerusalem, alongside remnants of his shattered army and additional reinforcements from Europe, initiated the siege to reclaim Arc and establish a stronghold for further crusade operations. The siege's early stages were marked by hardship and minimal progression. The Crusaders faced a well-fortified city. Arc was strong, and Saladin was aware of its significance, and he dispatched reinforcements and supplies to the city's defenders, turning the siege into a stalemate. Arrival of winter, along with the outbreak of disease and the scarcity of food, further exacerbated the besiegers' plight. To make things worse, by October the 4th, Saladin had positioned his army to the east of Arc, ready to confront the camp of Guy Lusignan. The Crusader forces had swollen to approximately 30,000 infantry and 2,000 cavalry by the end of September, bolstered by a Christian fleet of at least 102 ships, enforcing a blockade of the city. Facing them, Saladin's army comprised of units from Egypt, Kurd, Syria, and Mesopotamia, forming a semicircle around the eastern side of Arc. The battle that ensued was marked initially by disjointed engagements, notably between the Templars and Saladin's right wing. Despite the chaotic start, the Crusaders, leveraging their heavy cavalry and strategic deployment of crossbowmen, began to advance steadily. Saladin's centre and right flanks were pushed back, facing defeat. However, victory intoxication led many Crusaders to scatter in search of plunder, a lapse that Saladin seized upon. Rallying his light cavalry, he launched a counterattack against the vulnerable Crusaders, reaping a heavy toll until reinforcements from the Christian right flank stemmed the onslaught. Meanwhile, the Muslim garrison within Arc seized the moment when the Christian camp appeared undefended and launched an assault that plundered the Templars into dire straits. The battle saw high-ranking casualties on the Christian side, including Gerald de Ryderfort, the Grand Master of the Templars. As autumn progressed, the Siege of Arc evolved into a double encirclement, with Guy's forces successfully blockading the city by land, buoyed by the anticipation of Frederick Barbarossa's arrival. Despite a Muslim fleet breaking the sea blockade on October the 30th and additional reinforcement in October, the Crusaders managed to maintain the grip on the city, partially thanks to Conrad of Montferrat's timely resupply efforts. The arrival of King Philip II of France in 1191 April, followed by King Richard I of England in June 1191, brought fresh momentum to the Crusader camp. Richard in particular introduced several technological innovations in the siege. He brought with him trebuchets, siege towers and battering rams, and obviously helped reinforce the naval blockade. As Philip arrived and Richard arrived, Richard's conquest of Cyprus en route added a strategic dimension to the Crusaders' logistics. Despite initial setbacks, including illness among the leaders and delays in the arrival of reinforcements, the Crusaders intensified their efforts against Arc, utilizing the siege engines that Richard had brought with him. On July the 12th, 1191, after more than 2 years of siege, the defenders of Arc capitulated to the Crusader forces. The city's fall was a significant victory for the Crusade, providing a strategic base for future operations in the region. Following the city's capture and surrender, however, there was negotiations between Richard and Saladin. There was a release, or going to be a release, of Muslim prisoners held by Crusaders. When these negotiations stalled and the agreed ransom was not paid, Richard ordered the execution of around 2,700 Muslim prisoners. A decision that cast a long shadow over his legacy and the Crusade. This act dramatically affected the subsequent negotiations and encounters between the Crusader states and Muslim powers, harshening things. But the capture of Arc provided the Crusaders with a vital foothold in the region. It secured a key port city that would serve as a base for future operations in the Holy Land. The city's strategic location allowed for easier access to reinforcement and supplies from Europe, thus revitalizing the Crusader efforts to reclaim more territories from Muslim control. Now, after the siege, there was disagreements between Richard and Philip. The rivalry between Richard and Philip, which had simmered even before the Crusade, was exacerbated by the siege's outcome. The contention over who would hold supremacy in the newly captured territory, as well as the differing priorities and personal ambitions, led to a rift between the two kings. Richard's support for Guy of Lusignan as King of Jerusalem conflicted with Philip's support for Conrad of Montferrat, created a political schism among the Crusaders. Additionally, the distribution of spoils and control over strategic locations such as Arc became points of contention. These disagreements significantly impacted Philip's decision to leave the Crusade. Citing an illness and the need to address matters back in France, Philip announced his departure from the Holy Land in July 1191, shortly after the capture. However, underlying his departure were the unresolved disputes with Richard, and the dissatisfaction with the political and military direction of the Crusade. Philip's departure left Richard as the primary leader of the Crusader forces in the Holy Land. But with Philip's departure, Richard was left in command of a diminished yet still formidable force. The army consisted of knights and soldiers from various European regions, including England, Normandy, French territories, and smaller contingents from other Crusader states and orders such as the Templars, and also some Scottish forces as well. Despite the departure of Philip and his French contingent, Richard's forces remained a significant military presence in the region. The aftermath of the Siege of Arc thus set the stage for the next phase of the Crusade. After the capture of Arc, Richard felt he could lead his forces south, with the ultimate goal of recapturing Jerusalem. However, the coastal route to Jaffa was fraught with danger as Saladin's forces harassed the Crusader army through hit-and-run tactics. Richard organised his forces into a disciplined marching column, with infantry in the centre protected by cavalry on the flanks, to mitigate the threat of Muslim archers and maintain cohesion. Saladin, recognising an opportunity to decisively engage the Crusaders, assembled a large army and planned an ambush in the dense forest near Arsuf. The Battle of Arsuf began with Saladin's forces launching repeated attacks on the Crusader rear and flanks, attempting to provoke a premature charge by their knights. Richard, however, maintained discipline among his troops, ordering them to hold formation and resist engaging until the opportune moment. The Muslim archers used hit-and-run tactics, causing casualties among the Crusaders. Richard's patience and tactical acumen paid off when he finally ordered a counterattack after enduring hours of harassment. The heavy cavalry led by the Knights Templar charged at Saladin's forces, breaking through the Muslim lines with devastating effect. The disciplined charge combined with the shock of the heavily armoured knights turned the tide of the battle. Saladin's troops, unable to withstand the ferocity and momentum of the Crusader charge, were forced to retreat. Richard's ability to maintain this discipline and cohesion helped win the battle, but also this controlled cavalry charge, the timing and execution of which helped secure the win in the end. The Crusaders journeyed then towards Jerusalem after the significant victory at Arsuf on the 7th of September 1191 was marked by a series of strategic, logistical and diplomatic challenges. First, there was the logistical side. As they progressed through the Levant, they encountered severe logistical difficulties. The arid and often inhospitable terrain of the region, compounded by the scorched earth tactics employed by Saladin's forces, made resupplying a formidable task. Access to water, food, and fodder for horses became critical issues. Saladin's strategy to destroy or poison wells and to burn crops ensured that the Crusaders could not easily live off the land, forcing them to rely on long and vulnerable supply lines, stretching back to their coastal strongholds. Moreover, the approach towards Jerusalem involved traversing mountainous regions, which presented significant tactical challenges. In response to the Crusaders' movements, Saladin adopted his military strategy as we know. Rather than engaging in a pitched battle, he employed hit-and-run tactics and chose to face the army with a war of attrition. Avoiding direct engagements, he would pick off units using these hit-and-run tactics whilst also using a scorched earth policy. By the end of 1191, Richard faced a difficult decision on whether to proceed with the siege of Jerusalem. Despite nearing the city on two occasions, Richard ultimately decided against a direct assault. Several factors influenced this decision. There was obviously the logistical constraints that we mentioned. There was obviously the assessment of the Crusaders' ability to successfully besiege Jerusalem. These were not favourable, and even without securing a decisive victory over Saladin's forces in the field, a siege seemed a precarious endeavour. And Saladin could easily counterattack if they were to capture Jerusalem, which would then cut off Richard even more from the coast. Richard was acutely aware of the political and military responsibilities also waiting for him back home, particularly the threat poised by his brother, Prince John, and King Philip of France. Ultimately, Richard's decision not to attack Jerusalem was rooted in a pragmatic assessment to the Crusaders' military position and strategic realities of the campaign. This decision was met with disappointment, but it was a smart one and it would keep his army alive. So, how did things get resolved? Well, there was the Treaty of Jaffa, which concluded in September 1192, which marked the end of the Third Crusade. Negotiations for the Treaty of Jaffa were conducted between Richard, representing the Crusader forces, and Saladin, who was obviously representing the Muslim forces. The talks were marked by mutual respect between the two leaders, despite their fierce rivalry on the battlefield. The specific terms of the treaty were access to Jerusalem. While Jerusalem would remain under Muslim control, Christian pilgrims and merchants were allowed to have unimpeded access to the city, a significant concession given the religious importance of Jerusalem to Christianity. The treaty allowed the Crusaders to retain control over a strip of land along the coast, from Tyre to Jaffa, including the recently captured city of Jaffa. This provision ensured a Crusader foothold in the Holy Land and secured a safe passage for pilgrims travelling to Jerusalem. And then was also a 3-year armistice between the Crusader states and Saladin's empire, bringing a temporary halt to hostilities. And this would actually allow the Crusader states to survive a lot longer in the Holy Land. If it weren't for the Third Crusade and Richard's, well, efforts in securing the Treaty of Jaffa, the Crusader states would diminish a lot faster. But thanks to Richard, the Crusader states would stay alive a lot longer in the Middle East. This profound impact on balance of power in the region, by securing a corridor of coastal cities for the Crusaders, ensured that the Latin Kingdom of Jerusalem, though diminished, would remain a presence in the Holy Land. However, the fact that Jerusalem remained under Muslim control was seen as a failure by many Crusaders, and a significant victory for Saladin and the Muslim world. The treaty essentially solidified the status quo, minor territorial adjustments. The reaction to the treaty was mixed within both Christendom and Muslim world. In Europe, there was disappointment and frustration among those who had hoped for a complete recovery of Jerusalem. Richard's decision not to capture Jerusalem was criticised, though his efforts to secure Christian access to the city and retain a Crusader presence in the Holy Land were acknowledged as pragmatic. In the Muslim world, Saladin was both praised for defending Jerusalem and criticised for conceding coastal territories to the Crusaders. However, his ability to negotiate a favourable armistice and maintain control over Jerusalem solidified his reputation as a wise and formidable leader. The Third Crusade set a precedent for the European monarch's direct involvement in Crusades, illustrating the potential and pitfalls of such expeditions. The Crusades highlighted the logistical challenges of mounting such large-scale military campaigns across vast distances and the necessity of securing local bases like Cyprus for support. The failures and successes of the Third Crusade inform the strategies of subsequent Crusades, including the Fourth Crusade between 1202 and 1204, which ironically never reached the Holy Land and ended instead with the sack of Constantinople. The notion of a crusading as a noble endeavour for the faith continued, but the Third Crusade's limited territorial gain underscored the immense challenges of achieving lasting conquests in the Holy Land. But this is the History of Scotland podcast. Obviously, you should know that by now. So let's have a look at Scotland's participation in the Third Crusade. Well, we obviously know King William the Lion ruled during this time. The Scottish nobility and clergy were caught up in the crusading zeal just as much as any other crusading nation. While Scotland didn't have King William the Lion leading a crusader army like England and France, Scottish nobles and knights did participate in the crusade. One of the most notable figures was David of Scotland, Earl of Huntingdon, and yes, brother of King William. David was not only a key figure due to his royal lineage, but also because of his active participation and financial contributions to the Crusade. He had become quite close with Richard during the Treaty of Alluce, and he would take upon the cross to serve in King Richard's army. He embarked for the Holy Land around 1190 and is known to have spent considerable time there, although specific details of his actions are less documented than those of Richard the Lionheart. Other Scots, lesser known but equally committed, joined various contingents of Crusader forces, serving as knights or in supporting roles. The participation of these individuals underscored the interconnectedness of European nobility, bound by ties of kinship, feudal loyalty, and a shared religious commitment, especially, obviously, from our King William I's brother David. The Third Crusade's impact on Scotland was multifaceted. Financially, the effort to support Scots who went on the Crusade would have strained the resources of a kingdom already under pressure from a tribute paid to England. Politically, David of Huntingdon's involvement in the Crusade could have increased the prestige of the Scottish royal family and William the Lion's, albeit subtly by highlighting their active participation in the affairs of Christendom. The Crusade also occurred during a period of recalibration of Anglo-Scottish relations as we know. So, this did have an impact on Scotland, though it wasn't as sizable as the impact it had on England due to obviously not having really a giant leader over there, even though you could argue David of Huntingdon's leadership was also as significant. The First Crusade's legacy in Scotland, as in the rest of Europe, was a mixed one. It fostered a sense of participation in a larger Christian community and inspired future generations to take up the cross for the Holy Land. The Scottish Church also played a pivotal role in mobilising resources and manpower for the Third Crusade. The Church in Scotland, as is elsewhere in Christendom, was a vital supporter of the Crusades, driven by the papal call to reclaim the Holy Land from Muslim control. Financially, the Church levied taxes and collected donations known as Saladin tithes, named after the Muslim leader Saladin, who the Crusade aimed to defeat. This ecclesiastical taxation was a significant source of funding for the Crusade in Scotland, helping to outfit Scottish participations and participants with their journey and sustain them in the Holy Land. In terms of manpower, Scottish clergy and knights inspired by religious zeal participated in the Crusade and joined David of Huntingdon over there. Scottish clergy likely accompanied David and knights to provide spiritual support, although specific names and numbers are less documented compared to the secular leaders. While there are no records of Scottish Crusaders playing leading roles in the major battles or sieges of the First Crusade, it's plausible to come up with the Scots fought alongside their European counterparts in these crucial engagements, especially David of Huntingdon, who was noted for being a great leader on the battlefield. David's participation in the Crusade helped to elevate its status in the European stage, showcasing it as a kingdom committed to the broader Christian cause. Although the contributions were relatively modest, participation by Scottish nobles in these pan-European endeavours fostered diplomatic and martial ties with other crusading nations. Now, modern Scottish scholarship tends to view the country's role in the Crusades through a critical and nuanced lens, focusing on the motivations behind Scottish participation and its actual impact, such as, David of Huntingdon participating, most likely to keep King Richard I happy, making sure King William I of Scotland, his brother, could rule in Scotland successfully without any English nobles, causing any trouble, causing any wars, making sure that when Richard came back to the throne, he couldn't have a go at Scotland for not participating. Having such a crucial royal family member, such as David over there leading the Scottish forces, helped actually bring England and Scotland closer together. Contemporary historians emphasise the diversity of the Crusader involvement, moving beyond the martial aspect to explore the world and explore the social, economic and cultural dimensions of the Crusaders on Scottish society. The re-evaluation has led to a more balanced understanding of Scotland's contributions to the Crusades, recognising both the limitations and the significance of its involvement. The Crusades are now seen as a key chapter in Scotland's medieval history that contributed to its integration into the broader European cultural and political landscape, despite the modest scale of its participation. In summary, Scotland's participations in the Crusades, while not as prominent as that of the larger European powers, had lasting effects on its international relations, societal structure, cultural heritage, and economic development. The enduring legacies of the Crusades in Scotland are a testament to the country's engagement with this significant medieval phenomenon, reflecting a complex interplay of local and global dynamics. Well, I think we'll wrap up the Third Crusade here. We will probably touch upon the Fourth, Fifth and Sixth Crusade at some point. We'll probably touch upon it when we get to Edward Longshanks and his invasion of Scotland, since Edward Longshanks, Edward I of England, was actually a notorious crusader. So I think that'll be a good time to pick up the Crusades and probably put a final end to the story, let's say. This episode recapping, though condensed, hopefully illuminated new facets of this pivotal period, enriching your understanding of this great crusade. It has been a thrilling story, but as I keep mentioning with things like this, it was very complex to write, very complex to read through, and obviously we're on about 40 minutes through this episode. So just to say, this could probably fill many more hours of our podcast, but it isn't unfortunately the history of England, it is the history of Scotland, and we won't be telling a great story of the Third Crusade. It's just a nice bite-sized chunk to tickle your taste buds. And as I said, we might do a One Last Crusader special when we get round Edward the Longshank's invasion of England. We'll tell the story of Edward I, the final crusade, and then we'll end the story on the Crusades there. That way we've done about three sections of the Crusade. We've done the First Crusade, Third Crusade, and then Edward the First Crusade, plus any final moment of what happened during those many years in the Middle East. Anyway, next week we pivot back to our Scottish narrative, exploring the concluding chapters of William's significant reign. His tenure at the helm has seemed to pass swiftly, at least within the scope of our discussion spanning 8 episodes. Yet each chapter was laden with events that shaped Scotland and its legacy. As we prepare to bid adieu to William, one of Scotland's most longest reigning monarchs, we'll delve into the essence of his rule and the indelible marks it left on Scotland's historical tapestry. As mentioned, our podcast episodes roll out weekly, offering you a steady stream of historical exploration. This month, however, marks a special expansion, as we keep mentioning, with 4 episodes. So there will be one last episode next week, which will, as I mentioned, close William I's reign down. So that way we can go into April brand new. Stay connected with us through social media. Follow our Twitter handle at thehistoryofsc1. That is at the History of SE1, or like our Facebook page at the History of Scotland podcast for updates, trivia, and engaging discussions. Your thoughts and feedback are invaluable to us, so please consider leaving a review on your favourite podcasting platform. Thank you for all the recent reviews on Spotify and Apple Podcasts. I have read them, it's really great to see. As always, our podcast is available on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Google Podcasts, Podbean, and many other great podcasting sites. So, as we close this chapter on the Third Crusade and look forward to the next, we thank you for your continued support and curiosity. Have a fantastic week, guys, and until the next one, stay safe, have a good one, and I'll see you next time. Peace.